Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon, and as usual, we are coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting, and hope that you are listening across the state of Georgia to as we once again break down all that's happening in politics in the state and beyond. And boy, after the governor's veto message the other day and the reaction to it, we got a lot to talk about as in that area. Sumaya Khalifa from the Islamic Speakers Bureau is here. She is going to join us for the entire discussion. We'll also have a conversation with her about how the Islamic community is reacting to some of the rhetoric out on the campaign trail this year. So, Sumaya Khalifa, welcome to Political Rewind. We're glad to have you here.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be here.
Also, Eric Tannenblad. He is a Republican insider who's helped advise candidates at all levels of Republican politics, from president down to local races. And, of course, Jim Galloway, the political writer at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the editor of Political Insider, the daily blog that updates throughout every day online. Thank you all for being with us. By the way, you can tweet us and join the conversation. We're at PoliticsGPB, PoliticsGPB. We'd love to hear what you have to say. And I also want to quickly say that since we put that open of the show that you heard before the news, if you were with us, you heard that that Liz Flowers would be here. Our friend Liz called us to say she is under the weather, and so she's not here today.
Get better, Liz.
We want you to get better, Liz. Liz is about to leave Georgia. She's been the executive director of the Democratic Caucus in the state Senate for quite a while now. She's heading up to New York to a big job in politics, yes?
She's going to be a think tanker.
Yeah, think tanker. Okay, well, we're going to get Liz back before she goes to New York. Let's start by recapping what happened on Monday. Jim, I think I said, I think you probably did too, last week on this show on Friday, we said it would not surprise us, given the pressure that Governor Deal is under, if he took the Easter weekend to relax a little bit. But by Sunday night, we saw a press release announcing a news conference the next day about religious liberty. What happened, Jim?
Well, we had the tug of war between business and religious conservatives, and business and the LGBT community won. Governor Deal vetoed it.
On Monday morning, after sending out a news release early that morning, I think. Let's listen to just a little bit about what the governor had to say.
I do not think that we have to discriminate against anyone to protect the faith-based community in Georgia. Our actions on House Bill 757 are not just about protecting the faith-based community or providing business-friendly climate for job growth in Georgia. I believe it is about the character of our state. Georgia is a welcoming state. I intend to do my part to keep it that way.
So those are just some excerpts from his veto message. Eric Tannenblatt, I think many people who watched this unfold were really not surprised that that's what the governor chose to do, right?
I think it was an act of a governor doing what he was elected to do. He had to rise above the fray and sort of assess the situation, the pros and the cons, and I think he had to sort of try and block out all the noise. And this was obviously a passionate issue. The people on both sides of the issue felt very strongly about it and do what was right for the state. And governors have to represent the entire state, unlike legislators who just represent their constituents in their district. And there were a lot of different views on this bill. And he did what I think was the smart thing to do and the right thing to do for the state of Georgia.
Jim, in some ways, he had tipped his hand a little bit. He had said a week or more previously, when he was commenting on the fight over religious liberty bill before it was passed, that he'd be happy if nothing passed.
Right, right. And it, what struck me in his message was that he was part constitutional scholar, he was part theologian. The economic implications of this bill, he really played those down, I think. and focused on the danger of a legislature granting a religious community this right, and his logic was perfectly valid. You give them a right, you are also kind of doing some negative legislation. You're telling them what they can't do when you tell them what they can do.
And he also did explain how he was, you know, the pastor protection piece that passed, he was fine with that, but it was what was added to the bill when it got over to the Senate that was troublesome.
You know, it's interesting, Jim. You have a piece that you posted on Political Insider about the Archdiocese of Atlanta, which in previous versions of this fight, the year before, last year especially, really weighed in. This time they stayed on the sidelines.
Well, actually, what happened was in the first year okay. in 2014, they weighed in. They kind of formed an alliance with Southern Baptists on this issue and pushed it. In 2015, last year, they bowed out. This was after Pope Francis started kind of trying to change the tone of the dialogue over same-sex relations and the church. And they yesterday they put out another statement reflecting on Governor Deal's veto. This was including Archbishop Wilton Gregory, and said basically, you know, we need more dialogue and less emphasis on constantly revived legislation that returns to the Capitol year after year after year.
Sumaya, did the Islamic community, there were certainly imams who got involved in this in terms of the many people in the faith community who were concerned about this legislation.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the Muslim community is no different than other communities where you have the conservatives and you have the liberals. But for the most part, the bill basically is discriminatory. And I'm so glad that the governor vetoed it. Otherwise, you know, it started with LGBT, and you don't know what else is going to go in terms of other communities in Georgia. And I really thank the governor and applaud him for a decision that I'm sure was not an easy decision to make.
You know, I was interested, you raised this, Sumaya, I was interested in listening to the governor on Monday that he did, in fact, use the D word. He said discrimination in reference to this bill. And so many of the supporters of this, including the lieutenant governor, the Speaker of the House, have tried very hard to insist there is no discrimination in the bill. He went right there, Jim.
Right, right. And look, there was he had a slight advantage here in that North Carolina happened just a few days before us. And they passed the legislature there very quickly passed a religious liberty bill that was far more extensive than the one Georgia's had. It outlawed all local anti-discrimination ordinances issued by counties and cities, particularly Charlotte. And that struck a nerve with quite a few people here, I think, especially it sent some more shivers up the spines of the business community.
Yeah. Eric, the North Carolina legislation was particularly egregious to those who oppose it. One day special session, one day, no advance notice to legislators of the actual language of the bill they were going to consider. And it went through the House and Senate into the governor's desk on that same day, and it essentially really does open the door for discrimination against gays and lesbians, transgendered individuals in North Carolina. And Sumaya mentioned that, you know, the discrimination she sees in 757 may open that door too, but in North Carolina, it's now wide open.
Yeah, and in North Carolina, it was a reaction to a local ordinance that was passed in Charlotte, and that's why they reacted, you know, dealing with transgender use of bathrooms in local facilities, and that was why the legislature acted so quickly. But look, these are really hot issues, and issues where, as I said before, people are really passionate. The key now is what happens. And, you know, you have people on both sides. I think those that were supportive of the governor's actions hope that this is now going to die down. But then you have people that were disappointed in the governor's actions that are talking about living for another day and bringing this back up again. And I just hope that people could let the dust settle and maybe cooler heads can prevail and there can be some dialogue and discussion before rushing to try and revisit this and create the same situation we just put left behind us?
Well, when we look at the situation with North Carolina, the New York governor, he stopped all travel to the state of North Carolina as a way to protest on that law being passed there. So we need to stop and look at the repercussions that such actions do bring on.
You'll have an interesting political test out of this, because the Attorney General, who's a Democrat in North Carolina,
running against
Pat McCrory, the Republican incumbent, says he's not going to enforce this law. And so you've got a very, very direct election test of the implications here.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay, so before we go too far afield, let's get back to Georgia, because, Eric, you raised the question of what next. And it's interesting that you urge people to take a deep breath. There are just quick reactions that I'm going to read to you, and then we're going to listen to some sound. Speaker Ralston said he respects the governor, and he knows there was thoughtful consideration and all that good stuff. But then he says it's regrettable that the merits of this measure have been ignored in the days since its passage by critics who had not taken the time to read the bill or understand the legal issues involved. I take pride in the leadership role the House played in making Georgia the number one state in which to do business. And we all aspire for it to be a welcoming place. At the same time, we have a duty to the Georgians we serve to listen to their concerns. I'm not quite sure.
The problem is with a bill like this that is so complicated, and there have been lots of different legal interpretations, there's a broader message. And, you know, two, three years ago, we saw what happened in Arizona when, you know, they passed a RFRA bill and then Governor Brewer vetoed it. You saw what happened in Indiana last year and Arkansas last year. And the problem is that people in general are not looking at the details of the language of the bill, and it's more of the whole notion that this is they're just jumping to the conclusion that this is a discriminatory bill. And that's why I said I think cooler heads need to prevail. We need to sort of step back and see what is it that different groups are trying to accomplish with legislation, and see if there's some way to find a non-controversial way to do it without it being a big explosive debate like we've just witnessed.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem with HB 757 was that it was so vague in so many places. It was actually hard to say what it would and what it wouldn't do.
Well, you know, I want to ask you, all right, so...
But the pastor protection bill passed unanimously.
Oh, yes, yeah, and that was very specific. Right. And then things got tricky. But, Bill, you asked when this how this is going to play out. You're already seeing it play out in congressional races. Down in the 3rd District, Mike Krang, state senator, has already put out a fundraiser, email citing his fight for religious liberty as a reason to do that. The state GOP convention in Augusta on June 3rd and 4th is going to be a very dangerous place to be if you're Nathan Deal.
let's listen to some of the sound. The day after the governor said he would veto the bill, the coalition of people, informal coalition of supporters, all came together to hold a news conference to talk about what they planned to do. Ben Harbin, Representative Harbin, immediately called for a special session. There were some others who picked that up. But here's Tanya Diddy, who works with a women's coalition of conservatives on issues like this. Let's listen to what she said.
We're here to fight. That wasn't a game changer for us yesterday. We will continue to fight day after day after day until we see religious freedom protections passed in Georgia.
Jim Galloway reminds me, I said Ben Harbin. Of course, it's Marty Harbin. Thank you for that correction, Jim. Let's also listen to how Josh McCoon, Senator McCoon, who's been really out in the front on this thing. Let's hear what McCoon said right after he heard about the governor's message.
For the governor to veto a bill that only impacts pastors, houses of worship, religious schools, and religious nonprofits, it just sends a very chilling message to people of faith in the state.
Okay, so let's break this down. Eric, you call for cooler heads. first of all, it's interesting that while people like Harbin are calling for quick action in a special session, Josh McCoon, who was on our air within an hour after the governor's message, talked about coming back next year to deal with this. And I suspect that even that, except for the fiercest people on this thing who reacted very quickly, does anybody really think it's in their best interest to have a special session?
No, absolutely not. I mean, special sessions are for emergencies, and they cost money. I don't believe this is an emergency. Now, keep in mind, too, that, you know, unless you're in the leadership or you're a statewide elected official, you know, when you're a rank and file member of the legislature, it's hard to be heard. Now, this issue has become a cause célèbre for some people like Senator McCoon. And, you know, he has become a household name around the state because he has taken on this issue. And I think you find with a lot of red meat issues down at the legislature, it tends to be, you know, rank and file legislators that are looking to find something to get attention.
Now, to get call for the legislature to call itself into a special session requires a 3/5 vote of each chamber. And there wasn't a 3/5 vote available on HB 757. But, so it was hard to do that. But the other reason that you might have state lawmakers, other than Mr. McCoon, keeping quiet is that the governor has until May 3rd to sign a budget.
Right.
He's got the line item veto, and he can reach into your district, and he can just draw a line through whatever project he wants that you really, really, really wanted this session.
And my understanding is some of the legislators already had as a result of their
indeed.
Actions.
Why don't you fill us in? Yes. You picked up layout. On a Columbus Ledger article.
Yeah, this was just let me give a shout out to Chuck Williams over at the Columbus Ledger Inquirer. He had a story in which he had is it Richard Smith, I think,
yes.
Representative Richard yep. Smith, saying that Josh McCoon's activities on not just on religious liberty issues, but on a host of other areas had cost his region about $8 million in state funding for an infantry museum, and I think something from Columbus State, although I could be mistaken there.
No, I think that's right. Smith's I don't have the verbatim quote in front of me, but essentially said you can only poke somebody in the eye so many times before they're going to fight back.
Right. Now, in addition to some very, very sharp comments he made to the speaker about the when the House was holding up the religious liberty legislation, he introduced a bill that would have term limited the House Speaker, a Senate bill to term limit the leader of the other chamber, which obviously he was asked to withdraw that, and he did. Then there was another bill that would deprive Governor Deal of the power to fill a vacant U.S. Senate term. It was kind of a slap at both the Deal and Johnny Isaacson.
So what we really expect, Sumaya, is there won't be a special session, but we've already received assurances from all involved on the supporter side that they're going to be back. It'll probably be HB or SB 1 in one or the other, maybe both, when they come back next year. Is this community ready to continue this fight?
I think there's a lot of passion, as Eric mentioned before. There is a lot of passion on both sides, and I think the fight will continue. And it keeps coming back every year, and the fight will continue. Both sides are very passionate about it.
And this is an election year, and so all the legislators are going to go back out and either run for re-election or there'll be new legislators elected and see how much of an issue this becomes in the campaign.
The one thing that's different, of course, is they'll be working with a governor who has already expressed himself on the issue. There's no guesswork.
Well, that's what it puzzles me about this. The governor is still going to be clutching his veto pen tightly in his hand, and it's going to be hard to imagine they'll come up with some new compromise language that will please both sides.
It wouldn't surprise me if the governor came up with his own language.
Right. The governor voted for a religious freedom bill when he was in Congress, and he has indicated support but did not want discriminatory language in the
or
in
or effect.
Right, right. In the bill. And so, you know, I think, as I said, if cooler heads prevail and people can engage in a dialogue and not just, you know, get in their corner and just dig in, we're not going to have progress.
But let's say that scenario plays out. Governor Deal comes up with compromise language. It, you know, there's a fight because it doesn't go far enough to please one side or the other, but it passes. We then go to 2018, a governor's race, where this is almost certain to once again be a hot issue in that race. Casey Cagle has already staked a lot of his aspirations around religious liberty.
Yeah, he's pretty much raised his hand and said, I'm your guy.
Yeah, but you know what? We've got a long way to go. We got 2.5-3 years before the next governor's race, and I'm sure there'll be several other issues that are going to be before us between now and the 2018 election.
Well,
and there will be iteration of that bill as well.
Yeah. All right. So let's do this. Let's take a break in a second here. We all agree, though, that number one, not likely to be a special session, but this will be one of the big issues coming back in 2000. We'll all be sitting in this studio next December, January, February, talking about religious liberty again, right?
Well, if
that's
you're
depressing.
If we're lucky, the governor, maybe the speaker, maybe a few Senate leaders will come together, have something worked out in November and December. First day it's introduced, boom, we're through.
Okay, we're at Politics GPB and TB. Tweeting at T Barf, it's great, TB, says, I'm fine with the RFRA veto and non-discrimination in general, but are we really okay with men using women's locker rooms at a local public school? That refers to local pool. That refers, of course, to North Carolina. We haven't seen that introduced here yet in terms of where transgendered individuals can use the restroom, right? So let's do this. Let's take a break. It's 2:28 on Wednesday afternoon, and we'll come back in just a minute. Let's talk a bit about, with Sumaya Khalifa, about what's happening in the Islamic community as it watches, as they watch the rhetoric, particularly in the GOP race, of course, about Muslims unfold.
On the next Fresh Air, actor, writer, and comic Ray Romano talks about the new turn in his career.
I'm not a salesman. I'm a record man.
I know that.
Don't come in here and tell me to double down.
Romano co-stars as a record executive on the HBO series Vinyl, which was co-created by Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger. Romano starred in the sitcom Everybody Loves Raymond. Join us.
Fresh Air is today at 3 on your GPB station.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, AJC political reporter. Why do I, every time I say, want to say political writer, it comes out
journalist.
Reporter. Journalist. And Eric Tannenblatt, who has worked with Republican candidates at all levels of politics over the years and is a frequent part of our show. And joining us, Sumaya Khalifa, who you heard a little bit from in the first segment of the show. Sumaya is the head of the Islamic Speakers Bureau here in Georgia. She has established herself in her long time here as one of the leading spokespeople for the Islamic community in Georgia and beyond. And Sumaya, I think it's fair to say that one of your roles has been to work as an intermediary to help those of us who are not Muslim understand the religion and the community better and to be careful about preconceptions that we might have about Muslims, and then, of course, to work on large issues that affect the community, right?
That's absolutely right.
Okay.
Very well said, Bill.
Thank you. I'd like to do this. We obviously want to talk about the rhetoric we're hearing, especially out of the Republican candidates. Last week, after Brussels, well, let's go back even further. Let's go back to where this all sort of began. And that was Donald Trump last December after Paris made a statement that really electrified his supporters in a positive way and caused outrage in other quarters. Let's listen.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
So that was Trump last December. Now, after Brussels, we heard this from presidential candidate Ted Cruz responding to the Brussels attacks.
Political correctness costs lives. And it is standard law enforcement, it is good law enforcement, to focus on where threats are emanating from, and anywhere where there is a locus of radicalization, where there is an expanding presence of radical Islamic terrorism. We need law enforcement resources directed there. We need national security resources directed there. The object should be to keep Americans safe, to keep everyone safe.
So, Sumaya, Ted Cruz, in those remarks, as you well know, called for stepped-up patrols, security, law enforcement, in what he called Muslim neighborhoods, because he felt there is a threat there, could be potential threats there. And he equated them with gangs. He said if in communities where there's active gang warfare, it's not unusual for law enforcement to devote more resources to patrolling that community. Well, give us your first thoughts on all of this.
Wow. Well, I guess I want to start out with a cartoon that Mike Lukovich of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution put out on March the 24th. And the cartoon had a Muslim student, Muslim soldier, Muslim officer, Muslim doctor, Muslim teacher, and where do you go? So I think what the political candidates are missing is that Muslims have been part and parcel of this nation from the very get-go. A third of those who were enslaved were Muslims. When we look at the Muslim population here in Georgia and in the United States, the estimate is there is anywhere between 5 million to 10 million American Muslims. In Georgia alone, in Atlanta alone, there are 100,000 to 125,000 Muslims. And so we're talking
who don't live in neighborhoods, in specific
exactly,
neighborhoods.
Exactly. According to, that's a great point, Paul, because according to the Gallup organization, Muslim Americans are the most diverse religious group in the whole country.
What does that mean, most diverse?
In terms of ethnicity. There is no one ethnicity that's a majority. About a third are African Americans. About 30% or so are Indians and Pakistanis and Bangladeshis. About 20% are Arab Americans. And then the rest is everybody else. So there is no Muslims are not monolithic. They're very, very diverse.
Do we have any data on partisan affiliations in the Muslim community, whether members of the Muslim community tend to vote Democratic, Republican?
You know, that's a beautiful question, Bill.
That's what I'm paid for, Sumaya.
Bill, if I could jump in, I've got a good friend, Amjad Taufik. You know him, Sumaya. And, you know, we were having lunch one day, and he says, you know, if it weren't for Donald Trump and the Muslim remarks, he'd be very comfortable with most of the Republican platform.
Absolutely. Muslims tend to be more conservative. But when we look at the voting that happened with George W. Bush, the first term, most Muslims, American Muslims, were Republicans, and they voted for him the first term. The second term, they did not. They turned Democrats. And from then on, the American Muslims, they belong to both parties, but the majority tend to be Democrats at this time. So the rhetoric that we talked about, that we listened to, really distances the Muslims from being Republicans because they feel like they are the other. They're being targeted. They're not looked upon as part and parcel of this country. It's us and them, which is not a very healthy situation to be in. This is very fertile ground for the extremist to recruit. You think of yourself as an American, look at what the political candidates are. Here, we'll give you an identity. And that's what they really tap into with the youth who are misguided and they feel marginalized. So this is national security. We need to stop this because it's not about Muslims. It's about the constitutional values that each of us enjoys.
I have to say, in the aftermath of the Ted Cruz remarks, excuse me, I thought one of the most interesting and really kind of moving memes that I saw on Twitter was a hashtag called My Muslim Neighborhood, where people in the Islamic community around the country took photographs of their where they live. And of course, as Jim Galloway points out, it isn't as if there are these Islamic enclaves all over. And I would really suggest that if you're out there listening, check, go to that hashtag, just search My Muslim Neighborhood. It's really got some, it really says a lot about the breadth of the people in this community. You know, Eric, I think about it when I hear Sumaya, your candidate, Jeb Bush, now long gone from the race, he understood, I think, because of the way he talked about the importance of not demonizing Muslims, partly because I think that's just his nature, but also he understood you don't want to alienate a voting bloc out there.
Well, not only a voting bloc, but as you look at national security issues, you know, we need to work with our Muslim neighbors and allies in fighting Islamic terrorism. And it's not just Jeb Bush. I mean, Paul Ryan has been pretty vocal on this topic as well. And so I don't think you should take, yes, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz happen to be the top two candidates still left in the race running for the Republican nomination, but I don't believe that they represent all of the Republican Party. And quite honestly, I think that they're playing to people's fears. And yes, as a Republican, those are not comments that I aspire to join them and agree with them on.
No, look right after 9/11. I mean, George W. Bush specifically went to a mosque, and he specifically said that we are not at war with Islam. I mean, he said very much many of the same things that Barack Obama is saying right now. So he was very, very careful about trying not to generate what the radicals want, which is an Islam versus the West war.
Exactly. You know, the aftermath of the hate speech, and I'm not going to call it hate speech, is that it makes it open season on Muslims. We heard about the three young people who were killed in North Carolina, the three young men who were killed in Indiana. There was an elderly man in Washington, the state of Washington. There is so many backlashes. It is open season. Just the other day, sitting in a fast food restaurant, a gentleman walks in with a very negative statement on his T-shirt, and he had an open gun. So for a Muslim to be sitting there, it's very scary.
Sumaya, without regard to the most egregious examples of violence against Muslims, I'd be interested in knowing what's the day-to-day toll that this takes on you as an individual, just negotiating your life in the community around you. You know, and your fellow friends who are Muslims. I mean, how does this fit with your day-to-day life?
Well, we try to live a normal day-to-day life as citizens, as professionals, to do our job. But what really takes its toll on a lot of people are the unconscious biases that take place at the workplace, people or at the shopping center or at the schools, how people look at the Muslim children. We recently did a workshop for Muslim kids about self-esteem. Over 80% of the Muslim children have been harassed and have been bullied in schools. When one hears that, it really makes, one's heart break.
Let's do this. We talked just kind of briefly, but I'd like to do a little more with this, about how important it is. You know, we hear all the time, well, if the Muslims in this country were really, if they were really against terrorism, they'd be speaking up much more loudly. Well, of course, we know that there are Islamic leaders who have done that. But what we don't hear as much about is how law enforcement works in a positive way in the Islamic community, not only to deal with civil rights issues in the community, but also to have the cooperation of the Islamic community, the eyes and ears on those outliers who may in fact be bad guys, right? We did an interview with Steve Emmett. He's a special agent of FBI in the Atlanta office. And we talked to him about this very thing. Let's just take a few minutes and listen to what Agent Emmett had to say. Steve, how important is it to the FBI and to other law enforcement organizations to have a cooperative, positive working relationship with the Muslim community here in Atlanta and across the country?
Well, it's very important. We at the FBI in particular are responsive to any complaints involving civil rights violations that might be targeting those groups. But we also, from a counterterrorism standpoint, want to be well positioned to take tips and information from that community, from the Islamic community, on individuals within that group that may be radicalizing against U.S. or allied interests.
And so how does FBI cultivate that relationship?
Well, through relationships with individuals that have access to those groups or are leaders of that group, for instance, the Al-Farouq 14th Street Mosque here in Atlanta. We enjoy a good relationship with that mosque and the leaders of that mosque, and we've had constant opportunities to exchange information culturally and otherwise that puts us in good stead with that group. They understand what we're trying to do, and we understand more about their organization, their mosque, and it's enlightening to us as individuals and as government employees.
There is a popular trope among some people in this country that if the Muslim community in the United States really was concerned about terrorism, they would speak out publicly, much more loudly condemning terrorism. Without regard to whether we're hearing a lot of people speak up loudly or not, is it your sense that the American Muslim community is as concerned about Islamic terrorists as the rest of us?
Well, by and large, I think they are. I think it is hard to broad brush the Islamic community. You have such a wide range of pockets, you know, of that community. We enjoy a good relationship with our Islamic community here in the Metro Atlanta area. Detroit, for instance, might be a little bit different, but the overall effort is to recognize what they offer to us and for them to offer or to understand what we offer, When events such as Brussels or Paris happen, passions, emotions, et cetera, are really driving some of this discussion. And unfortunately, not all of it is fact-based. So I would be reluctant to say such a statement.
So you're suggesting that in some communities, like in Detroit, there might be a bit more skepticism and concern about working with law enforcement.
Right. It comes down to whether you have the religious leaders there, the imams or other community leaders.
Like a Sumaya Khalifa, who's here in our studio for this show.
That's correct. You know, we had her over at our office in 2012. Very informative to hear her talk, and we recognized her with a Director's Community Leadership Award in that regard. She understands bridge building. We understand it, but in some communities, that's more of a challenge than we've seen here.
FBI Special Agent Steve Emmett. Sumaya, congratulations on your FBI award. I do want to quickly pick up on something he said, though. Emmett is making it clear that while he believes FBI here, for the most part, has a very positive relationship with the Islamic community, he's also acknowledging that there are places where this is a tricky proposition because there are people of more radical beliefs out there, in he says, in a city like Detroit. Is that a fair statement on his part?
Well, I think it all boils down to building trust. And it's a two-way street. So if trust is broken, then it becomes very difficult to form partnerships. We have been very lucky in the Metro Atlanta area to have great relationship with the U.S. Attorney's Office, with the FBI here in Atlanta. But it is a give and take. It is building trust. When the whole thing about the New York Police Department broke, about them wiretapping and having certain surveillance on mosques, et cetera, that does not build trust. That breaks down trust. So we need to look at that. Also want to talk about the countering extremism. There is a split in the Muslim community about to engage or not to engage. Bringing that again about the building trust piece. Most people feel like it's a partnership between the American Muslim community and law enforcement. And what happens then is there are others who say, why are we being singled out? There are terrorists and there are terrorism in other spaces and other communities. Why are the Muslims being singled out? And also the Muslim community has gotten to a point where there's an expectation that when something happens in Brussels or in Paris or in San Bernardino, then the whole Muslim community is expected to apologize for it. Well, I had nothing to do with it. And so we find that there is double standards in dealing with terrorists who happen to use the veneer of religion to cover their horrific acts, and between those who happen to be Muslims and others who are not. So this is really of a concern to the American Muslim community.
You know, it's right after the Paris attacks, I was at a mosque service that featured Imam Arshad Anwar of Roswell, who has developed a program. I mean, he addresses Muslim youth, and you know, tries to warn them away from ISIL and radicalism. And one of his is the warning signs he gives to parents is that, is your kid spending too much time on the internet?
Yes.
You know, if your kid's logged on at 2 a.m. in the morning, that's a problem. Because this was his message, either he's talking to somebody from ISIL or he's talking to somebody from the federal government who's posing as ISIL. So there's a little double agent veneer there. Cool.
But we're going to have to take a break in a second. But Eric Soumayam even makes the point more strongly that when we hear any candidate, and you're right, it just happens it's the two remaining Republican candidates right now who are espousing a lot of this, demonizing the community, in addition to everything else, it is hurting the ability of law enforcement to gain intelligence in a positive working relationship with Muslims.
You're absolutely right, and I think it's inexcusable, because I think what these people are doing is they're really trying to appeal to people's anger in a way that I think is destructive for the overall community.
You know what? Before we break, I want to play one more soundbite. And Sumai, I think we've all heard this, but I think it's worth, as we go out on this particular segment. You know, the police commissioner in New York, Bill Bratton, responded. He had, and now his boss is a Democrat and a Hillary Clinton supporter, so we stay that out front. But Bill Bratton, I thought, really put this, for many people, in perspective when he talked about the Cruz remarks at a news conference last week.
I would remind the senator he lives in the United States of America. And the statements he made today is why he's not going to become president of this country, because we don't need a president that doesn't respect the values that form the foundation of this country. As the mayor mentioned, I have over 900 very dedicated officers in this department, many of whom do double duty. They serve as active duty members of the U.S. military in combat, something the senator has never seen. So before he starts denigrating any population group, take a close look at who he's denigrating. I take great offense at his characterization of that whole population, particularly with my intimacy with the population in my organization of Muslim officers who are willing to sacrifice their lives in foreign countries and every day step up willing to sacrifice their lives here.
That's Bill Bratton in New York. That's the kind of thing you would like to hear, standing up.
We need more leaders like that. And I want to say something. You know, we're talking about the negative aspects of what's going on. But I have to tell you, for every negative voice that we hear, every negative encounter that we hear, there are tens, if not hundreds, of people who come forward and say, this is not me. I am a Christian or I am a Jew, and this does not speak on my behalf. We are there with you as brothers and sisters, and this is not America, and this is not, does not speak for me.
Right. And I'll also add, Bill Bratton was the police commissioner under Rudy Giuliani. So, you know,
okay.
So if we want to bring partisanship, just because these two presidential candidates are making these, you know, comments does not mean that it's a reflective of the whole party.
I think that's absolutely right. And as you pointed out, we pointed out your candidate, Jeb Bush, wasn't talking that way. John Kasich certainly isn't talking that way. So point well made.
Jeb Bush?
Yeah, that's right. Before we take the break, Martha Sanders, who's tweeting as Martha Mee, says, if you don't hear Muslims decrying terror, it's probably because you don't know any. It's a Political Rewind at 2:51 in the afternoon. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about two words, Corey Lewandowski.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's vehicle donation program is here to help. Donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227, and thanks so much. Beep, 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 beep,
yeah. Welcome back to Political Rewind. With me in the studio today, Jim Galloway of the AJC, Eric Tannenblatt, and Sue Maya Khalifa. So, let's set the table for this, Jim Galloway. Yesterday morning, Ted Cruz got a big endorsement. Scott Walker, a week plus ahead of, or just a week ahead of the big and important Wisconsin primary, endorsed Ted Cruz. And that was the news story all day. It was the headline news. Nobody could talk about Corey Lewandowski, what happened?
Okay, this happened in Florida a couple of weeks ago, did it not? You had a Breitbart reporter who's very
Michelle Fields,
a pro-Trump organization, kind of walking out of the rally with Donald Trump. She is grabbed by the campaign manager. He grabbed her and shoved her aside so that he could walk next to Trump. I've got to say, as an assault, it's minor grade.
Pretty minor.
Far worse has happened to me. On the other hand, the Trump campaign denied the video. We have video of it now. He's been charged with assault.
Misdemeanor. Battery, I think.
Right. And we have video of it, and they're still saying it didn't happen.
So, you know what's interesting?
And
Trump
provided the video. It was his video.
It was his
camera.
Security video. Okay, so here's one of the things that I find fascinating about this, Eric Tannenblatt. This is a different kind of event, but it is nevertheless true. The cover-up is always worse than the crime. I think that there's a reasonable argument to be made that certainly nobody should be shoving a reporter. We get that. But there's a reasonable argument to be made that had Lewandowski just apologized to Michelle Fields and said, gee, I'm sorry, I got a little carried away. By the way, how about if I give you a couple minutes alone with her? Something like that, it would have gone away because it wasn't that egregious, some people think. But the way Trump is responding, he's doubled down on everything that people are concerned about in terms of how he feels about women, how he feels about never being wrong, you know?
Well, and he never apologizes.
Right.
So why should he expect that from, you know, his top lieutenant? They never apologize. The thing that is just mind-boggling to me, I mean, you're talking about nominating a candidate to be the president of the United States. I mean, this is like a reality TV show, this presidential campaign. It's almost like the Jerry Springer show, and we're talking about who we're going to nominate to be the president, the commander in chief. It is just mind-boggling to someone like me who's been involved in politics and have worked with presidents to see this going on.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
No, it's just it is absolutely amazing to me that the Trump campaign has done away with the fact It is, the fact doesn't no longer exist.
Yeah, I mean, we've stopped living in a. I think this is the culmination, not the beginning, Jim. This is what we've gotten to because we don't live in a reality or fact-based society anymore. Trump happens to be the ultimate example of that. His latest comments on this are, she had a pen in her hand. And, you know, the Secret Service doesn't, you can't do that. The Secret Service doesn't want you to do that. Well, that's about as silly of an argument as you can make.
Oh, yeah. I should have been arrested, three or four dozen times then. Right.
Well, and this was on the heels of this little spat between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump over their wives.
Right.
And the photos being disclosed. I mean, it's just, this is, it's laughable.
All right, Sumaya, you are the woman at this table today, so you are therefore now representing all women.
All right.
How does this play out there? This is probably not going to hurt Donald Trump in his quest for the Republican nomination. Do you both agree with that? Maybe not.
Well, it won't hurt him with his own supporters. I think what it does do is it does make people that are not for him even.
Oh, okay, yeah. Fine. But he's on a path to be the likely nominee. But what happens when he faces a larger population of women in the general election?
As a woman, I'm very disturbed about what happened to this reporter. You know, that was just totally unacceptable.
Yeah.
And the cover-up is even worse.
Yeah, and I'm not sure when you say he has the most delegates right now, but I'm not sure he's going to cross that threshold.
Yeah.
And then I don't know what's going to happen.
Okay, that's fair enough. Let's very quickly, we're going to have a whole show talking about presidential politics on Friday. And in fact, we have Joe Crispino, the Jimmy Carter Professor of American and Southern History, coming in to draw parallels between what's happening now and past American political races. And that'll be fascinating. But with the minute we've got left, we're headed to Wisconsin next week, Jim. Huge for Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Sanders is really hoping to make some noise and gain some momentum there, right?
Hillary Clinton can put the race away in Wisconsin if she wants to.
Right.
Bernie takes it from her. Then New York becomes so, so important.
Yeah.
And that's that,
April 14th.
April 14th.
Yeah. Yeah. And on the other side of it, if Donald Trump wins Wisconsin, then, Eric, your best hopes for stopping him become a little bit dimmer, right? A little bit.
Yeah, but I still think it's going to be a tough path for him to get to 1237.
Okay. There you heard from a regular Republican, a man who is in the establishment with his best hopes out front leading the way. Eric Tadenblatt, it's great to have you here. Jim Galloway, you as well. And Sumaya Khalifa, thank you so much for joining us today for Political Rewind. It's all the time we have for today's show. Remember that if you can't be near a radio, you can download the Political Rewind podcast from iTunes, or you can listen to it on the gpb.org website. We catalog all of our shows there. Those of you who have contacted us to say that the podcast isn't updating, you're right. We've been having some technical issues. We've moved to a new platform, but we are hoping to resolve those problems as quickly as we can. And I must tell you, it's sort of delightful to me that it matters enough to you that you really can't wait for us to get it working again. So thank you all for your interest in the show. That's it for this week. We'll be back Friday at 3, as I said, with Joe Crispino, with Jim Galloway, and our panel. Until then, I'm Bill Nygut. See you Friday.